WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Dear purveyors of senseless violence, I know this may sound silly at first, but I believe that the cartoons you show to our children are influencing their behavior in a negative way. Please try to tone down the psychotic violence in your otherwise fine programming. Yours truly, Marge Simpson.
Take a letter, Miss White. Dear valued viewer, thank you for taking an interest in the Itchy and Scratchy program. Enclosed is a personally autographed photo of America's favorite cat and mouse team to add to your collection. In regards to your specific comments about the show, our research indicates that one person cannot make a difference, no matter how big a screwball she is. So let me close by saying...
And the horse I rode in on! I'll show them what one screwball can do!
That was one of the great episodes of The Simpsons in which Marge campaigned against cartoon violence. The Simpsons were created by cartoonist Matt Groening and first appeared as a regular feature on The Tracey Ullman Show. My guests Al Jean and Michael Reese have been writing for The Simpsons ever since the series hit prime time in January of 1990. Jean and Reese have also written for The Tonight Show, It's Gary Shandling Show, and Sledgehammer. They've been partners since their college days at Harvard, and they're just two of the many writers written about in an article on how Harvard changed comedy, published in the current issue of Harvard Magazine. The Simpsons episode in which Marge takes her stand against cartoon violence is a favorite around here, so I asked Jean and Reese about how and why they wrote it.
The cartoons that they watched on The Simpsons, the Itchy and Scratchy show, were extremely violent, so she led a crusade and actually got them to tone down their violence, and the cartoons were really pathetic without violence. They were really lame. So kids didn't watch them, and then they went out and they started... riding bikes and building things and having fun. And, you know, it seemed like a golden age, but then Michelangelo's David was going to tour Springfield, and then the same people that wanted to censor the cartoons wanted to put pants on the statue, and Marge realized that you can't really censor one thing without saying that censorship is okay in all forms. For a children's show, or, you know, quote-unquote children's show, it really had a lot to say.
It's sort of typical of a Simpsons episode, which is it made a lot of points that all canceled each other out. The show really doesn't have a platform.
The other thing is we're sort of crusading against violent cartoons, but of course we got the show about 10 minutes of very violent cartoons, so we were kind of playing both ends against the middle.
Well, the violent cartoons that you show are Itchy and Scratchy, which kind of regularly appear in the series, and all they do is just kind of like beat on each other with a hammer. I mean, that's the whole, there is no plot, or there's not even as much plot as there is in a Roadrunner cartoon.
No, in fact, they usually average about 6 seconds long. So if it was a real cartoon, you really wouldn't, you know, get much out of them.
We generally even spend longer writing the title of the cartoon than writing the rest of it. Something like Bang the Cat Slowly was one title, and that took about 2 hours, and the rest of the cartoon was pretty easy to do.
Have you ever gotten angry responses from the equivalent of people who want to censor violent cartoons? People who complain about how the family is portrayed on The Simpsons.
You know, we used to get complaints, especially when the Underachiever t-shirt was really prominent. But I think that a lot of people, when they watch the show and actually sit down and look at it, realize that the show actually has a strong moral center. And in fact, when people on The Simpsons do something wrong, it's almost like they get punished far worse than people would in real life.
Didn't Dan Quayle once say something about The Simpsons?
No, his boss, the George Bush, said... America should be more like the Waltons and less like the Simpsons. And we did a rejoinder a couple of days later where Bart said, "We are like the Waltons. We're all praying for an end to the Depression."
So I hope that doesn't get the show killed. But.
And I didn't see it a couple of weeks ago, but I heard you did something in response to Dan Quayle's Murphy Brown. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It was in response to Dan Quayle's potato misspelling.
Yeah, this was actually Matt's idea. We had we have the chalkboard at the beginning of the show, and those are actually done about a few days in advance. So after Quayle's incident, we just had Bart writing on the chalkboard, potato, spelled correctly, not potato with the extra E that Dan Quayle put on. So that's just our little kick.
You've been writing for The Simpsons since it became a TV, you know, a regular scheduled TV series. What was it like at the beginning when you were taking over from Matt Groening, who did a shorter version of it for the Tracy Ullman show? What kind of
Well, at the very start, Matt, in addition to Sam Simon and Jim Brooks, the two other executive producers on the show, wanted to take these little, you know, 2-minute shorts and turn them into a series, which, you know, at the time seemed a lot more difficult than people may think now. And Mike and I had just been on the Gary Shandling show, and, you know, we took the job because, frankly, we had no other offers. And we were kind of embarrassed because we were writing for a cartoon, and we thought, geez, I don't know if this is going to go anywhere. Although we thought that the stories they were throwing out were really funny, and, it, you know, we were the first staff writers. And then when the first episode, the first full-length episode aired at Christmas of 1989, we had a, you know, a jacket from the show, and I went to Epcot Center, and suddenly everybody was like coming up to me and saying, that was the greatest show, you know, can I buy your jacket? And, you know, like fights breaking out around me and things like that. And it was just surprising. We said, gee, this is, you know, really something special.
Did you relate to the family when you started writing for them? And I'm wondering, you know, as Harvard guys, did you relate to this, like, working-class dysfunctional family?
Well, you know, both of us went to public school, and I think our families are a little more similar to The Simpsons than we'd care to admit.
And as we get older, right, we see we're all becoming a little more like Homer than we'd like to admit. We get all get very happy when someone brings a box of donuts into the room, and we smack our lips a lot more than we used to.
Now, how do you work with the animators? Do you write the scripts first and then hand it over to them?
Yeah, the first thing we do is write the script and then record the audio track with the cast.
We record it like a radio show. It takes about 8 hours, and we cut it down to about 19 minutes of audio track. And then that's sent to the animators, who expand it to about 24 minutes.
We have a team of 6 guys who are terrific. They, you know, they direct the way a movie director directs a feature. And, you know, they take the script and they pretty much stage the whole thing, design the characters. And then we see a real rough version in black and white called an animatic. We do some rewrites there. And then we send the whole thing to Korea. And that's where the actual color animation is done. It comes back about 3 months later. So right now we just finished recording our Valentine's Day show for 93.
You're really working far ahead.
Yeah, we really are. In fact, in about a month, we will be pitching out what will be our season premiere in 93, September 93.
Nobody's this far
ahead. That's how far ahead we have to work. And it's sort of a good thing, which is we throw in some topical allusions, but I think it's going to make the show a little more, it'll be a little timeless because we can't ride every current thing and get a quick laugh off of something that's in the news right now.
A bad thing that happens is we'll use a name like Rex Harrison or somebody, and then he'll die before the show airs, so we have to change it. It's sort of like there's a curse. And then we did a big joke about the Soviet Union and it died. So we have to just kind of be careful.
We had a little thing where Jackie Mason appeared on the show, and they flew to New York to record him, and he just made some reference to Isaac Bashevis Singer. And then a couple of months later, reading the paper, Isaac Bashevis Singer dies. Isaac Bashevis Singer dies. Oh, no. And we had to fly back to New York and get him to replace the line with Saul Bellow. And then for the next 2 months, we were praying, Saul Bellow, please don't die. And, you know, these prayers were going out to him, and I think he didn't know why.
Some of my favorite episodes are ones with guest stars like Jackie Mason or Joe Mantegna. How did you start working with guest stars like that?
Well, initially, people who were friends of the producers, for example, Danny DeVito is a friend of Jim Brooks, would express interest in doing the show. A big reason is that they have kids, and their kids would like to see them on the show. That's how Sting agreed to do it. His kids were fans. And then, you know, it's sort of a snowball thing. It's just we found that, you know, people like doing the show because it's an easy job, and they can come in for a couple hours. We'll even go to them. And then we, you know, we of course really enjoy writing for these people. So this season we got a lot coming up. We have Bob Hope, we have Tom Jones,
Adam West, the original Batman, that really got everyone excited.
We have Sarah Gilbert from Roseanne, who plays a girl that Bart falls in love with for his first crush.
Danny DeVito will be back. Joe Frazier's on. It's been sort of a wish list. It's a lot of people, I think, that our staff wanted to meet.
Mike, I understand that in back of your desk you have a picture of Maury Amsterdam, who played Buddy, one of the writers on the Dick Van Dyke show.
How'd that get out?
Oh, it's in that Harvard Magazine article about comedy writers who are alums of Harvard.
Now, he is wearing clothes in the photo. I hope that...
So did watching the Dick Van Dyke Show make you really want to write for television?
Absolutely. It's and Maury Amsterdam was my hero, the way Hank Aaron would be some normal kid's hero. I just loved the show, and Dick Van Dyke lived in New Rochelle, so I started dating a girl from New Rochelle, and I didn't like the town, and I didn't like her very much. But, yeah, it was a huge influence on me, and...
I think a lot of comedy writers saw that and said, you know, that's what I want to do for a living. My favorite show was The Honeymooners, so I wanted to really be poor and live in a terrible apartment.
Well, do you see The Simpsons as being in a way like The Honeymooners with kids?
Yes, I think there is an influence. I mean, that was a great show. And what was good about that show that we hope to emulate is, besides being really funny, you really felt that the characters were real. You really thought that they had a slice of life and that they, you know, taught you a little bit about the human condition. And if we're good, we hope we do that, too.
Let me ask you about the character of Krusty the Clown, you know, who's a regular on The Simpsons. When you were kids, did you used to watch any shows with clowns, and did you really hate the clowns?
Actually, I was on the Bozo Show in Detroit where I grew up, and I had a Krusty-like incident where I was, you know, about 8 years old, and I was in the audience, and Krusty came in to talk, or Bozo came in to talk to the kids, and he sat on me, and you really, you know, I didn't realize just watching on TV, he's really heavy, he's like 200 pounds, so that was very traumatic, you know, maybe that influences us a little.
Were you a regular on the show, or was it just
no.
In the audience?
Yes, I got sat on every week.
It was Sideshow Al.
No, just one time. It was like, you know, one of those things where you had to, you know, write, you know, for weeks in advance to get tickets, and, you know, I went on my birthday, and so there's a little bit of that. You know, what's funny is we hear from people who work with, you know, clowns, you know, who say, you wouldn't believe how true Krusty is. You know? I guess these clowns don't treat their employees very well.
I had a friend who worked for Bozo Enterprises, and he said there was an incident they hushed up in Chicago or somewhere where the Chicago Bozo, I don't want to offend whichever Bozo, there's one bad Bozo that can ruin it for everyone, but apparently the Bozo had jumped on some production assistant, and they were pulling him off her, and he said, she wanted it from me. She wanted it from me in the suit.
Oh, boy. did you like kid shows when you were growing up, or did you find them insipid?
Oh, we were kids, you know. Mm-hmm. When you're a kid, you like kid shows. You don't know what else there is. But, you know, now I say that there's definitely different levels of quality to these shows. You know, and there's ones that I liked as a kid that I don't like as much now.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Al Jean and Mike Reese. They're both executive producers of The Simpsons. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about The Simpsons with two of the show's executive producers, Al Jean and Mike Reese. You wrote for The Tonight Show together for a year.
Mm-hmm.
What were you writing, sketches or monologues?
We wrote the sketches. We wrote Carnacks. Pretty much anything that's written that isn't the monologue is what we did. There's, you know, obviously back when Johnny was still the host.
And we wrote what was like desk material, which would be like Johnny's 10 tips to beat the heat and that kind of thing.
Was that fun to do?
Yeah, it was interesting because we actually didn't see Johnny very much, nor did we have much contact with the other writers. We just sort of sat in our office and would write. Pretty much we wrote 60 jokes a day, so 300 a week. Not that they were all good jokes, mind you, but we would hand them in. And it was just sort of like being, you know, at, you know, the Latin American Bureau of IBM or something.
Yeah.
You'd come in, you'd do your little bit, and then you would go. And
It was so compartmentalized, too, that the... there was a staff of sketch writers and a staff of monologue writers, and they were in separate buildings across the studio lot from each other. And I guess in our 2 years there, we never met all the monologue writers. And in all that time, we maybe spent an hour with Carson totally, never knew who we were.
Well, that must have felt pretty odd. You know, you're supposed to be writing something for someone who you really understand so well that you know what makes them tick and what their sense of humor is. I guess maybe you knew that from watching him for so many years.
No, that's about it. I think he's a private man. And, you know, we would just watch the show like other people did, just for, you know, clues to what he wanted and, you know, what he was like.
You know, it's funny. Carson's of such a different generation than you are. You graduated Harvard in 81. So did you feel like you had to really write for somebody who was very different from you and would have a really different sense of humor from you?
What we were trying to do is just sort of you know, keep the show current, but, you know, also write things like Karnak and, you know, The Edge of Wetness, which are his old standbys. So it was sort of in the middle of that, you know. The one thing he would try to keep references to topical material. I mean, the show was always, you know, doing a monologue about what happened that day, but we wouldn't always do, you know, the latest MTV reference or something.
It was weird to just get in his mindset. When we were working there, we were just two single guys trying to get dates all the time, but when we'd be writing for him, it would always be about divorces and divorce lawyers.
Yeah, crummy lawyers.
how bad the food is in Malibu, things like that.
How does an extremely wealthy man think?
right. Let me get back to the Simpsons. Are there aspects of your family life that you've ever written into an episode?
Since we work on the show all the time, there, you know, is maybe 1 hour's worth of family life a week, but we do suck that into the show. I mean, we do draw from anything that happens to us.
Yeah, it's because we can pour everything into the show. I think it does draw on everybody's childhood. We've really sucked everyone dry at the show. And what I'm actually curious to see this coming season, I've thrown a lot of my family's traumas into the show, and I haven't told them, and I'm going to see if they recognize them and if they get mad at me.
Can I ask you to give an example of something that happened in your lives, either as children or as adults, you know, in your family that you've used on an episode?
A little one would be when we were kids, my dad would want us to say grace, and my sister would go, rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub, and he'd get really mad. So we put that in an episode with Bart. Let's see.
There's one coming up next season where Homer wants Bart to have a nice bed and so he builds these clown beds for him that have a big clown head on the front and big feet at the foot of the bed, and the premise is you're supposed to be happy because you're sleeping in a clown's guts, and Homer paints this very grotesque clown face on the clown, and it gives Bart nightmares, and he's very scared, and he wants to stay as far from the beds as possible. And this is something that actually my father did when I was a kid.
He made a bed like that for you?
He made a clown bed, and it was, the face was so creepy. It had these dark, sunken eyes and big, black, flaring nostrils that the kids finally sawed the heads off the clowns and stuck them in the closet with the faces facing the back wall.
That's great. You know, when I was a kid, I used to have dreams about psychotic clowns and menacing Santa Clauses.
Now, we have a friend also from Harvard who was petrified by a clown when he was a kid and had nightmares about clowns for years, and he finally turned it into a new Fox series called Circus, where it is just about what horrible people clowns are.
Were you good kids when you were growing up?
Yeah, pretty good.
Pretty decent. Bookworms and...
We were nerds, we'll admit it.
Yeah.
So you weren't Bart Simpson types?
No, I don't think anyone was exactly like that. You'd have to have a lot of energy to be that mischievous all the time.
No, I'm afraid most of our staff was a bunch of Lisa Simpsons.
Yeah, that's actually, if there's one character we relate to most, you know, completely when we're writing, I think it's Lisa. I mean, Bart's really funny, but we relate to Homer when we're hungry.
Are there any changes coming up in the characters for next season?
No, one advantage of being animated is that we can, you know, our characters don't have to grow older. You know, we don't have to have, like, kids age, you know, poorly like Teeny Others did on Family Ties. And we can just sort of stay. Bart's always 10, Lisa's always 8. The relationships between the family are always the same.
What we generally do, and it's our advantage over most shows, is that it can expand outward. We can always just go more places. Instead of people getting sick of seeing the same 6 characters every week, we probably have a repertory company of about 40 or 50 regular characters that we can keep bringing back. So it always seems a lot fresher, I think, but that's why we don't have to send the family to Hawaii for a 6-episode, you know, stint.
There are a couple things. Like I mentioned, you know, Bart falls in love for the first time, and Maggie will actually talk. We'll say her first word, but I won't. I'm not at liberty to disclose what that word is.
She's not going to graduate from her pacifier, is she?
No, she'll keep the pacifier.
No, she'll say her first
word. We know a good thing.
And then nothing again, so it's even a little sad.
The Simpsons has a reputation for keeping the writers working really, really hard. And from what you've said, it sounds like, you know, you're working all the time, and you're also working really far ahead. it sounds like a real grind sometimes. I mean, do you have to work that far ahead?
Well, there's a couple factors. One is with the animation, you do have to work, you know, 8 months ahead because it's just required.
Sure,
A lot of it, too, is the writers are self-motivated. You have people who are... The show has had such a high standard, at least we feel that way, that no one wants to be the one who let it slip. You know, no one wants to be the one that wrote the really crummy episode or... And, I mean, it's partly to the credit of all these people that work on it. The cast, too. I mean, everybody just... You know, realizes that they have a unique opportunity, and nobody, you know, wants to let it go downhill. I've been in some great shows, but I've seen, you know, this one has just this remarkable level of achievement that it's been able to consistently maintain. It's really unbelievable.
So, do you hope to stay in TV for a long time?
It's you know, we've been working at this furious pace for the past 3 years on The Simpsons, and then. It's Gary Shandling show for the 2 years before that was another long haul, a very, very long hour. So I think when we're done at The Simpsons, we'd at least like to decompress and take a job that's a little less pressure. I think if you could get normal hours on a sitcom job, a 40-hour-a-week job, I think I'd do it forever. It's an awful lot of fun, but it's just there are very few shows like that.
Yeah, I hope to work till my second stroke.
As professional comedy writers, do you quip a lot around the house, like characters in sitcoms always do?
At home, it's more like, oh, I'm so tired. Oh, well, there's the baby. I better go say hello. We do have a lot of laughs around the office, but it's never about the script.
Yeah.
The fun stuff is always just talking about, you know, the elections or, you know, things that when we're wasting time and we're not, you know, doing things that are connected with the show, that's fun.
It's really as funny as it gets. It'll be rolling and everyone's laughing and then someone's got to say, well, let's get back to those damn Simpsons.
Well, I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks.
Al Jean and Mike Reese are executive producers of The Simpsons. I'm Terry Gross and this is Fresh Air.